Welcome to the Ether. Today is Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. Today on the Ether, coinage, crypto, breaking news. Well, it was on the 23rd. Doquan, Coinbase, Farcaster, and more. Let's take a listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, a very busy Thursday on the Coinage Chat. Of course, the theme that we've been exploring for quite some time has been Web3 social. And what that space is doing to revolutionize social media. And of course, we are going to get into that with a very special guest on the show today. Dan Romero is the co-founder of Farcaster and former VP at Coinbase. Excited to be chatting with him today. But also, just want to quickly highlight the news that we will be chatting about roughly, throughout our spaces today for Coinage. There's a lot to get to. Reports Doquan has been arrested, the founder of Terra, arrested in Montenegro. We'll get into that later on in the space, as well as the fact that Coinbase is being served a Wells notice from the SEC, who also sued Tron. There's a lot of headlines to get to. But as I said, we want to open up with welcoming in our guest. We also have the director of marketing here, our head of community, Christy, is joining on in this space.
I'm almost positive Zach only brought me onto the space because, Dan, I have been using Farcaster for a while, and I know the platform better than anyone else here.
That's not entirely true.
You
that's not the only reason why.
The other day after I publicly shamed you on Twitter.
Well, that's not the only reason why, of course. You know, everyone right now is waking up to the power of social media in Web3. But now I want to welcome our guest, Dan Romero, the co-founder of Farcaster. Dan, thanks so much for hopping on the space with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's exciting to chat with you because I feel like you've been building in this space for a while. We always like having founders on to chat about their experiences. And of course, right now, I think hearing from founders who have been around maybe longer than a lot of our listeners have, putting into context, you know, some of the fears, the panic, the vibes right now in Web3 and in crypto, and we're seeing all of these headlines. Just first kind of want to start there with your take, because you were tweeting about the SEC and Coinbase news yesterday in terms of a Wells notice being bad for crypto, but you kind of had a bit of a different take in terms of, look, this is where the rubber meets the road, and this is where really all of crypto kind of, I guess, is looking to get answers in a way that Coinbase has almost kind of gone about it and trying to be above board. So I guess we'll start with just your thoughts on where we're at right now as a space.
Yeah, so maybe helpful context. I was an early employee at Coinbase, joined in 2014, and was there for 5 years, ran the consumer business for a while. And throughout our entire time that I was there, the 2014 and 2019, we had zero federal regulatory clarity. And we still exist in that environment today. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there that the SEC has deemed certain crypto assets to be, you know, securities, or the CFTC has called them commodities. It's just not true. There have been certain instances where certain projects have settled with the SEC with what you call an enforcement action. But there's no place to go look up like a kind of like, okay, is this thing a security or not? It just hasn't happened. And so the entire history of crypto, everything has been in a legal gray area, right? There are a certain set of laws and regulations that are on the books. But most of those laws and regulations were, you know, from like the 30s and 40s. And so the most prominent example with the SEC is something called the Howey test. And you can go look this up. It's a Supreme Court case from the 1940s about orange groves. And so if you think about what the considerations from the Supreme Court were when they were trying to determine whether or not something was a security about a farmer who had orange groves, and then a try to apply that to something like crypto, of course that sounds comical. But the reality is the only body that can actually really update those rules and regulations to the modern era is Congress. And so we're kind of living in this environment where the SEC has not provided any clarity to the entire industry. And we are now going to start to get that clarity from probably two cases, right? So the first is Ripple's actually been in court with the SEC for a while. The SEC has said that Ripple's a security. So Ripple said, we're not going to just take an enforcement action. We're going to go to court. So that court case is kind of going through the system. And now you're going to have Coinbase. At least if you kind of, based on the tweets, it sounds like they are going to, rather than settle with the SEC, they are going to take everything to court. And then what ends up happening is that you have the court make the determination on whether or not, you know, whether it's a certain set of assets that Coinbase has listed or maybe the staking product is a security. And so Coinbase gets to make the case, SEC gets to make the case, and then the court will actually decide. And all this will be public, right?
Yeah.
It's usually what with all of the stuff with the SEC, when you have an enforcement action, that's a private negotiated settlement between the SEC and whatever party. And they always have this kind of like standard boilerplate language. I'm not a lawyer, but it's kind of like no admission of wrongdoing or criminal activity or whatever. But like BlockFi is a good example. If you just go look, BlockFi SEC settlement, they settled for $100 million, right? And so I think in this case, what will happen is it's very similar to actually what happened to Coinbase with the IRS. So if you've been in crypto long enough, a few years ago, the IRS actually basically sued Coinbase for all customer records.
Yeah.
And the company came back and said, hey, look, like, this is, you know, we're going to follow the law. We follow subpoenas, but you just can't like get all customer records because you're the IRS. And so they went to court and they ended up settling for something that was more reasonable. And so I would imagine that's probably what's going to happen with Coinbase. But the important thing to note is these cases take years. And so what we have is like a current SEC that is under a certain administration. Remember, the SEC is a political appointment. That come 2024, you could have a completely different group of people in charge.
Yeah.
So cynical take here is actually that this is a Gary Gensler putting this out, getting it so that he can kind of claim, hey, I went after all of the crypto companies. You notice that all of them have basically now been served with a Wells notice, but he doesn't go finish the case.
Well, it's been interesting to watch, I guess, because, you know, we've had more and more clarity that this is kind of a coordinated effort coming out of the White House. So, you know, a lot of the activity had always been at the SEC, but now it almost seems as if, you know, we're starting to see coordination and, you know, on the banking side, that was obviously, I guess, the first piece of proof was you were looking at kind of the ways that the OCC, the Fed, and everybody was kind of working together on the banking to reel in the crypto industry after we saw Signature shut down, as well as Silvergate. And so now you're kind of looking at the SEC become very aggressive. And I guess it is interesting to think about your experience there, just in the way that Brian Armstrong came back and started tweeting about this as well, because we have seen it before. And you probably know better than I do what that whole kind of strategy is, because in his tweet thread, you know, again, this is coming in the context of Coinbase shares being down about 15% today as investors react to the SEC hitting them with a Wells notice. It's just kind of what he was saying in terms of, you know, we understand this to be part of the journey. This is his tweet. Reforming our financial system, we are on the right side of the law, confident in the facts, and welcome the opportunity for Coinbase, by extension, the broader crypto community, to get a shot, to get before a court. And I guess that's kind of also your point, is that, look, agencies like the SEC will go above and beyond where I think their mandate is, and then you've got the other branches of government that are set up that way to maybe hope that they are the ones that can come in and kind of arbitrate this. Is that kind of the right way to be thinking about it?
Yeah. So two things. So first, on the banking side, that was actually my first job at Coinbase. So I managed all of the bank relationships, all of the major US banks that have any crypto business. I was basically their first customer. And so lived through the difficulty of finding and establishing crypto to fiat on-ramp rails, right? So like maintaining that bank relationship is extremely difficult for US-based crypto companies. And there's a reason that there are very few companies that actually kind of have the nice, easy consumer experience on the payment side that Coinbase does, because those fiat on-ramps are extremely difficult. And if you want to learn a little bit more of the history of this, is there was an effort in the early 2010s under the Obama administration called Operation Choke Point. And it was specifically targeted towards a certain type of business that banks were you know, kind of banking, called the money service business. And the area that they were focused on were check cashing, casinos, kind of like mom and pop financial services that would exploit consumers. So there's some, you know, kind of good intention there of like maybe trying to make that market a little more transparent and fair. But the second order effect of Operation Choke Point was basically all major banks wanted to get out of the money service business, banking business. And so the way to think about a money service business is it's a business that moves money around as part of its business, but they aren't a bank, right? A bank, it requires actually a special license. The government post-financial crisis basically doesn't give out banking licenses anymore. So it's actually pretty critical for a whole segment of the economy. Take fintech, for example. A ton of those businesses, whether you're Square or Stripe, you're actually a money service business. You have to go get special state-level licenses called money transmitter licenses. Coinbase has those licenses. And access to the banking system, you as a money transmitter, you just can't go get an account with the Fed and then have access to ACH and wires. Like, you actually still need a bank to provide you access to that system. And so Operation Choke Point happened, and then it kind of like petered out a bit and things started to warm up. But I think where we are right now, and Nick Carter has done amazing writing on this for the Substack called Pirate Wires.
So that was one of the first things I think set a lot of people off. And we've been documenting here at Coinage as well, just because we had Caitlin Long on the show. She's done a great job as well, highlighting, you know, from her perspective in, 25 years on Wall Street, how these things go. And she's seen this and now kind of has been very loudly shouting along with Nick that this is real and this is happening. And, I think a lot of people first looked at it, maybe on the outside, if you're not in crypto, you might have looked at it and said, interesting conspiracy theory. But increasingly, it's impossible, I think, to deny that this is actually happening and the facts are stacking up. But I mean...
Well, yeah. So let me just break it down, because I actually don't think it's any one party outside of maybe some of the political pressure coming from up top. So from a bank's perspective, money service business, they don't have like... kind of stable deposits. You have a lot of money moving in and out. So you can make money on the kind of the actual payment volume. But even there, like that's kind of a commodity. So it's like hard to make that much money off of it. And what you end up getting is if you have a bunch of money service business clients, you get way more scrutiny from your regulator, right? So it actually creates a lot more work and process. And so you start to weigh off the, do I take this customer who, you know, can provide me with some amount of revenue over here, for the trade-off of a massive amount more regulatory and compliance scrutiny coming from the regulator? And from the regulator's perspective, they're just like, oh man, I don't want to have to regulate a bank that has this kind of customer. That's more work for me. So they can kind of nudge and say, hey, if you were to get rid of this customer, or if you weren't banking this class of customer money service businesses, we are going to spend less time pushing you on X or Y. And so the bank actually just takes it as an economic trade-off. It's not even like a philosophical conspiracy theory. But ultimately where this comes from is you actually have a very fragmented set of banking regulators in the United States. So there's a federal banking regulator, the OCC, and that regulates a certain set of banks. Then you have the Fed and the FDIC, which are kind of these other quasi-regulators. And then you have state regulated banks, right? So there's actually state banking regulators, the most prominent being in New York Department of Financial Services, which actually has something called the BIT license. So you have this alphabet soup of regulators, all of whom kind of don't really want to have to deal with crypto banks. They're not going to come out and say it outright, because then they're going to get in kind of like trouble from a press and or potentially get sued in court. But the thing is that there's no like law guaranteeing access to the payment system. What would actually change it is if you were a crypto company and you followed all the rules and you got all the licenses, you could now have direct access to ACH and wires, just like a bank, right? And no fractional reserve, you'd have to be one-to-one and all this other kind of stuff. But actually getting access to the payment rails, then we wouldn't have this issue. But so it's this kind of the thing where it's like if you're a senator on the Senate Banking Committee, and you write an open letter to the regulator and saying, I demand to understand how you're allowing crypto companies, that just kind of cascades downhill to the point where some of these banks start either moving out, or in this case of the FDIC, failures of both, Signature and then Silvergate's voluntary wind down, you quickly run out of banking partners in the industry. Sorry, it's maybe a little like kind of in the weeds, but no, it's important. Realize,
it's very important, because I think, you know, as we play this game out, a lot of people right now in crypto and beyond are wondering what happens. And, you know, this is kind of the link between it's essentially, you know, strangling off an industry. And when we say, when we're talking about Choke Point 2.0, is just blocking banking access. And of course, you know, the crypto space is still reliant. When you think about the size of the crypto space in general, still reliant on money flowing into it, which requires banking rails because that's how money moves from the traditional fiat world into crypto. And if you cut that off, what happens? And I think it's also interesting and a good maybe segue into Web3 social, because we're talking about cutting off financial access to crypto and kind of, you know, money. But the idea being, all right, what happens then now too, and maybe this is your thoughts on Web2 social, is what happens if you can just cut off access in general to information or choke off, you know, ideas? And we've seen that in terms of throttling off ideas on Web2 social media platforms. And I don't know if that's a good way to segue into it, Dan, or the way you think about it, or the way why there's such a need for Web3 social. And, you know, Chrissy's been sitting next to me, and clearly she has a lot of experience working with Web2 social media platforms. But that's kind of, I guess, how I would link these two things from a big picture perspective. I don't know if that's kind of the way that you answer when people say, why do you need Web3 social media?
Yeah, so I think it's actually a decent comparison, because what you're actually worried about with social media is not actually the hosting of the content, right? You can go do your own website and put all that content and speech up on your own website. The thing that you care about access to Web2 social media, whether that's Twitter or YouTube or Instagram or anything equivalent, is the distribution, right? It's the direct relationship between you and an audience. And in the case of, you know, whether it's Twitter or YouTube, anyone who clicks follow or subscribe has voluntarily said, hey, I want to see more of this content. And if you go and spend 10 years building up a massive audience, a couple million people, and then overnight having one of those platforms just turn off access to that audience, there's no, you get to export it, or you can kind of like use a different provider to then actually still reach those people. Contrast that to something like email, whereas if you have an email newsletter and your provider, whether it's MailChimp or Substack, hey, we don't want to work with you anymore. You export that email list, you move to a different provider, and you can continue to still speak to your audience. And so that distribution is actually very reminiscent of those fiat rails, right? So it's like the actual bank account itself is not as important as access to the ability to connect to a customer's bank account or a customer's debit card. And so distribution is the actual thing that is hard and worth having, at least from a social media standpoint, in my opinion, a kind of protocol-based approach where the only people who get to decide who gets to distribute content to whom are the kind of creator of the content and then their audience. And specifically, it's actually the audience's decision to follow you or not. It's you don't kind of own that relationship as the creator. It's you've earned the right from your audience to continue to speak to them, but you don't have to worry about some third-party company coming in and turning off that audience that you spent a really hard time building.
I like when you're talking, because it sounds kind of like, you know, the head of Instagram, Adam. He's saying kind of something very similar to where he thinks the future of social media is going to be. The creators having more control, not only of where their fan base is, where their content is showing, but access to the fans. So like whenever a fan pays for that subscription on Instagram, that subscription is directly going to the creator itself. So like monetizing it in a way that it goes directly to the creators, like connecting the two. Is that something that Farcaster is going to do in the future? Is that something that Web3 will help solve?
So I think it's useful just to kind of define Farcaster as a much lower level protocol around just ensuring that you get access to distribution, right? So if you're the creator or the person publishing and people who choose to follow you, that relationship is between you and the audience, not no one else, right? And so I can switch whatever client I'm using to do the publishing. They can consume that content on other clients. And I think of monetization as actually one layer up. Mm-hmm. And so you can choose how you'd want to monetize the content, right? So I think actually for most creators, they're still going to want to have credit card payments, in-app purchases, just a better consumer experience today. Whereas I think in the future, maybe crypto and kind of like more decentralized ways of doing monetization may gain adoption. But I think what's important is if you distribute the or you decentralize the distribution and actually put that into a protocol, you actually let the market decide on what the best ways to do monetization, and you let a creator decide what's best for them. And I think if you think about Instagram's monetization model, they are allowing people to do some amount of monetization, but they take a cut.
Yes,
they're
a big cut.
But here's the thing. Facebook can turn around and complain about all the rules Apple has with its app store, right? Oh, ATT tracking, all that kind of stuff. It's like, this is so unfair. Like, you know, like Apple should have an open ecosystem. Yet on the Instagram, if you think of that kind of like an app store, There's no third party I can't go bring my own payment processor or different things.
Nope.
And I'm not even necessarily arguing that that should be the case, in the sense that you do actually get a better consumer experience usually when you have a vertically integrated experience. But it is a bit hypocritical where they complain about the App Store being closed, yet that Instagram itself is the exact same thing, just within that realm.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people in Web3 got sad when they saw Instagram moving away from focusing in on NFTs. But I think a lot of people also probably saw that coming as an inevitability, if I were to say so myself.
I think you struggled on the word a bit.
I did struggle on the word a little Instagram bit. I will say I didn't say inevitability as properly as I should have. But Dan, when we talk about Farcaster specifically, in how it's different, I guess, than all the other social media, Web3 social media alternatives, I think that that's an important question to highlight as well, because I like the description that I've seen thus far from Farcaster in terms of sufficiently decentralized social platform. I don't know what that means necessarily relative to, I don't know if that's a shot at other ones, or I don't know if it means that you're moving further and further decentralized as it goes on. But why don't you talk to us just about like where Farcaster is in its evolution in getting something like this started, and how hard that is. When you think about the network effects that basically make the Instagram, the Facebooks, the Twitters of the world so powerful once they have all these people on the platform.
Yeah, so I think sufficiently decentralized is not a shot at anybody else. It's actually just a kind of philosophy that we have in terms of like how do you go and design a decentralized social network?
Yeah.
And if you think of the spectrum of entirely centralized on one side and entirely decentralized on another, and to use examples, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, entirely centralized. On the other side, you have things like secure scuttlebutt or these really esoteric protocols where everyone, when they host their content, it's on their own machine and it's completely peer-to-peer and there are no centralized servers. It's almost like BitTorrent, right? And if you think about that spectrum, the centralized systems have billions of people using them. The consumer experience and user experience is extraordinary, right? Like people spend hours per day using those apps. People find utility from them, right? Like the people genuinely enjoy using centralized social media. And anyone who's trying to tell you otherwise is like a terminally online person that like is like spending most of their time on Twitter talking about social media, where it's like the average person.
Hey, get out of here.
Yeah, it's entertainment. It's entertainment, right? So it's like any version that it's like, oh, it's completely broken for consumers. It's like, no, it's not. You can make an argument that for creators, there's, you know, the rent extraction on the payment side, the ability to lose your audience that you worked hard building. So that I think is a little bit more of an intellectually honest argument. But in terms of like if you were going to go to design a decentralized protocol, which side do you start from? You start from the completely decentralized side and then try to build it from there, or do you start from the centralized side and then work your way towards the decentralized side of things? And so that's the concept of sufficient decentralization is. Start with the user experience that you want and try to make that as simple and easy to use as possible, like Web2, centralized social media, and then work to find the right amount of decentralization that you need so that you can actually have like a credibly neutral platform and protocol where a consumer is free or a creator is free to move between any different service provider or client in a way that if they don't like the way, you know, our company's Warpcast, if they don't like the way Warpcast is doing something, they can move to an alternative client without losing access to their audience, right? So that kind of identity becomes portable. And a very simple analogy from the traditional internet or web one is email. So if you have your email hosted with G Suite, right, for Coinage, and you just decide that the feature set and or you just don't want to support Google anymore, you have the ability to just move your email over to, you know, Microsoft Outlook, or you can run your own email server or Proton Mail or pick your favorite email provider. But that you have complete interoperability with all of the other email people or people you were emailing before. And so that is where we want to head to, is a sufficiently decentralized social network where no one vendor service provider can lock in and start to rent extract and then make decisions that people, if they disagree with, don't have another viable alternative, right? Like there is no way to use YouTube or Twitter or Instagram if you don't agree with what that centralized company is doing.
So then I get the need for that as well. But whenever I see some of the issues with social media right now, I'm seeing that it started off as a way to connect with your friends, your family. And it's just, that's not what social media is anymore. It's become a distraction in every user's day. So if there is a way to connect all of the platforms that we're currently on, you know, if we're just talking Web2, like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and have it hosted in one place to where we're not constantly checking every single app every day. Is that something that you see happening? Is that something you see as a possibility with Web3?
Yeah, so I think it's a good point, but it's worth kind of breaking down the different social networks. And it's actually interesting. We use this term social networks versus social media interchangeably. But if you actually think about what each of those mean, Facebook is like traditional big blue Facebook app. That's a social network, right? Like you connect with people, like you have that, they have to approve your request. The expectation of what you post there is it's private and it's kind of narrow cast to that social network. Twitter or YouTube or Instagram, and Instagram's interesting because it kind of blends between the two. But if you're a big creator on those platforms, it's default public. It's a unidirectional follow model, right? So someone can follow you and I don't have to accept their request, right? It's like you're building a media platform, thus the term social media. And so it's really interesting when like Facebook and Twitter Facebook and YouTube get conflated because they're very different. Yeah, you can have a Facebook page, but the dominant way of using Facebook is actually much more social networking than social media, which is very much about broadcast. And so I think where we've started with Farcaster is to say broadcast is actually the area to focus on initially, because that's where the potential pain point is when you have a large audience as a creator or a publisher, is you lose access to that audience, right? Additionally, in a decentralized version of the world, achieving the level of privacy, and I know Facebook's had years of like kind of privacy mishaps, but effectively if you use Facebook right now, the default is pretty private. Like to do that in a decentralized way, maybe you can do it with some fancy ZK proofs or things like that, but it's actually significantly more difficult. Whereas actually implementing something like Twitter that's focused on distribution and everything is default public, still hard, but it is actually much more achievable where we are today. So what I think that the evolution of decentralized social media plays out is you focus on the broadcast use cases first, and there's still a long road to get there, right? Zach mentioned the network effects. Like you're talking decentralized social media is in the thousands of total daily active users across basically all platforms today. If you include Mastodon, maybe you're in the tens of thousands, but we're really, really early there. But if you play it out, like most likely if this all works out, you're going to have broadcast be the first thing to get solved. And then once you have a sufficient number of people who are actually active in a decentralized kind of like broadcast ecosystem, then I think you're going to have smart developers and entrepreneurs start building the more private use cases.
Yeah.
Especially as the technology on the ZK side improves.
Yeah, I think that's honestly the most fascinating piece of it. And honestly, why I wanted to quit in the traditional media world, the CNBC's, the Yahoo Finance life that I lived, into launching a community owned and operated media organization, which, you know, is governed by our NFT holders. And we're a legal registered cooperative to where people can actually earn dividends from what we do. Because I do think there is going to be increasingly new ways of thinking about distributing information, but also growing a brand like that in Web3 and co-ownership of news because of bias and the way that we've seen, I guess, the old version of social media kind of rely on what you just described in terms of that one directional, unidirectional way that a lot of these incentive structures are built. We had a lot of people join the space after we launched. I just kind of want to reset, if you're just joining us now, and explain what we're talking about today with our guest, Dan Romero, the co-founder a Farcaster and former vice president at Coinbase, discussing why there is this flow of new users into Web3 social media. And I don't even know, since we've been talking for 30 minutes, I don't even know if that's the right way to be describing these things. But just kind of co-ownership around all of these new network effects that are being unlocked in Web3. Also have Christy here as well, our head of community, who's joined the space.
Yeah, I've been a social media marketer for about 9 years now. So I've got a lot of experience with Web 2. Web 3 only for the past year. I think, and like Zach, you were getting at this a little bit when you were talking about Coinage's model, how we're trying to shift media so where it's community owned. And we get rid of a lot of that fake news cycle because we're monitored and, you know, checked by our own community. What I see is a massive problem with Facebook is fake news cycle. I hate the term, but it is real. The amount that Facebook perpetuates a lot of these conspiracy theories, the fake news that we're seeing. How is Web3 going to solve that?
Yeah, so I don't know if Web3 solves that.
Yeah, that's what I also think.
That's an honest answer. I like that, Dan. We've been chatting with a lot of Web3.
Intellectually honesty is like the only thing that like you can't operate building something if you're not intellectually honest, right?
Yeah.
So I think where I think it improves it over time is if you have a marketplace of clients and services, mm-hmm. people are going to be able to opt into the service that best suits them. And if you kind of imagine, let's say all the major social networks now are completely decentralized from a protocol standpoint, you can choose any service provider or client. Just let's do a quick hypothetical. Do you think the client that does a good job with its algo of kind of de-emphasizing conspiracy theories and fake news outcompetes from a broad, like how many number of like users and customers to one that is rife with spam and conspiracy theories and abuse and all that other kind of stuff? I generally think most people are going to want to use the kind of like well lit, nice experience, right? Like,
Social has gotten really popular, and we're like, I see that as like the biggest problem with social media is like the spread of this misinformation. I mean, think about the elections, how that happened. This is still happening with Facebook. I mean, Facebook is a very dangerous place for this reason. And how is it that Web3 could fix that? Because that is the biggest problem. I'm afraid that if we do have these platforms that's still not monitoring or checking what's going out there, this is only going to become a bigger problem. I just don't see that being good for society. And I hate saying the word society.
So let me give you two things. So first, we have the First Amendment in the United States, so we're always going to have conspiracy theories. Like, it's impossible to get rid of them.
Yep.
And that's actually just like foundational to how things work. So outside of changing that, conspiracy theories are a protected version of speech. Okay. So like we're just going to have those. I think the second thing to think about is look at the web, right? Do you think that the ability to anyone can go register a domain and then host a website, is that problematic?
No. I mean, I would say that that's not problematic. I don't know what Chris is going to say.
Let's say, just that basic statement. Anyone can go register a domain, put up whatever they believe on a website.
That by itself is not problematic.
Yeah, okay. I see that. But if you're the one hosting it, isn't that...
All right, let's see where Dan's going with this.
Yeah, sorry, Dan.
Right. So you immediately nailed it. So hosting now becomes a liability. So we have laws in the US of like what can be hosted versus not. People choose to host content versus not. But that's a free marketplace. So you can go use a provider who might be willing to support your website with more wacky views or conspiracy theory views. And maybe there are no providers for that, but because of the way the web works, because it's a permissionless decentralized protocol, you could self-host. The reason I'm going to posit, the reason you don't actually think it's as big of an issue is by having a website, you don't have any distribution from the start,
yep.
right? Having a website is just like basically putting something screaming into the void and then no one's necessarily going to find it. So the only way for you to spread that information is through channels for distribution. And so distribution and algorithms, like, by the way, there's an old school version of this is Google search, right? So if Google indexes your wacky views and you put like whatever conspiracy into Google, and this is actually more old school Google, because I think Google does a lot more censorship now in terms of like what they think is okay to put.
Yeah.
But more importantly, if Google was to index your page, now you have distribution. Now you have you're able to connect with all the other wacky people on the internet, and the internet's a pretty big place. If Google does not decide to index your web page, you get no distribution. But here's the thing about the web. Because anyone can go create a search engine, in theory, being indexed by Google is not nearly as controversial of an issue, in the sense that you don't have people protesting like with Tucker Carlson or whatever and saying, hey, I was de-indexed by Google. Maybe like, you know, some fringe people. Where people put most of their effort in complaining about being censored is social media, because social media is the fastest way to get actually an audience distribution.
Sure.
And so if you move to a model where there isn't an omni-algo, right? Like there is only one algorithm for Instagram. It's centrally administered. There is only one algorithm from YouTube. There is only one algorithm from Twitter. If you move to a model where you have a dozen plus clients and each one has its own algo, you immediately start to lower the temperature, because what might play well in conspiracy theory client, okay, which by the way is going to have a very small number of people,
yeah.
is not going to play well in the mainstream client, the Gmail equivalent. And so that marginal person on the fringe who would have potentially gotten exposed to this idea, if you really believe that this is like as much of an issue, I personally don't, but let's just assume for a second that it's true. That person's never going to get exposed to it because they're going to be using a client that like makes the social media experience well lit. It just gets rid of all the kind of conspiracy spam and whatever. And that's an adult making a choice to use that client. And so I think that that's what the beauty of the web is when you actually have a free market for clients, most people opt for the one that is just like the best user experience. And the best user experience probably doesn't have conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I don't know if it does or it doesn't, because that is the question. It's like if you can self-select.
But that's your choice. You get to decide what's important for you.
Yeah, yes. I believe in that.
Consumer choice.
Yes. You get to. I guess that's the biggest question, right? In terms of like on a user perspective versus a societal perspective, like which one's better? And this is where we get very philosophical. And I'm not entirely sure we wanted to do this per se on the space, because I don't know if that's boring or not. But as you explore some of these things, that is pretty interesting, because you think about Pizzagate and the idea of all these claims that you have. People who are in echo chambers, they start to believe more of their things and can be, I believe the term is radicalized in terms of the information they're consuming. And mostly, I don't necessarily think about it from that angle. I think about it more from the angle of, is it possible to like, I don't know, get to a worse spot in society if we move post-fact? As a journalist, that's mostly what my lens is. So I'm just looking at it as if you move post-fact, and the idea, as you said, Dan, you know, algorithms basically, currently as it is, basically hopping on the sexiest thing, whether it's true or not. And that's on the person to decide. That's on the user to decide. Is this real? And maybe over time you stop following accounts that just spew nonsense. But I'm excited by the idea of starting to incentivize things in a better way, rather than incentivizing and the algorithms basically the sexiest, most sensationalized thing into a world like you're describing, where essentially you incentivize the most moderate, factually correct thing, which is kind of how we design Coinage, because it's the same thing, fact-checking and allowing the community to basically steer something in the most objectively true direction that everyone agrees on. But that's just kind of where I'm coming from.
Okay, I also want to specify, I wasn't just talking like conspiracy theories. Obviously, I shot that one out. It's the first thing I think of. But, you know, I have so much angst against Facebook for a lot of reasons. But the biggest one is that it's such a dangerous place to be. I mean, human trafficking has a massive ecosystem in Facebook. So that's what I was trying to see, like if there was a way to check that with Web3 Social.
Well, so let me push back on that a little bit. So let's say Facebook is perfect and cleans it all up. And all of that bad activity, which doesn't go away because Facebook exists or not, it existed before and it'll exist post that, unfortunately. That's just a reality. It all moves to Signal. So Signal is completely end-to-end encrypted, and there is no way to monitor it. What should we get rid of Signal? And encryption, like, so, you know, journalists who are using this to report on, you know, I don't know, genocides or kind of human rights violations all over the world in dangerous regimes.
Yeah.
Like, should we say that end-to-end encryption now should not be allowed because bad people use it? By the way, since the beginning of the internet, people have been making these claims. Like when email first came out, if you just go to the New York Times and you kind of set the parameters for the 90s and you talk about, like, just search email and read the articles about it. Oh, this is going to be used for criminals. It's going to be used for, you know, child pornographers or like whatever.
It always goes to child porn too. Yeah.
But like this is the challenge with technology, is it always will be used by the worst people because it's powerful. But it also will enable all of these other important use cases because it's also powerful. Like to say the internet, like if you just step back and it's like, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens on the internet. Should we shut it down?
Yeah, that is the main thing. We explored this too with Eric Voorhees last season in a discussion around, you know, the idea of censorship and control and all this and what it enables. And it's really just a tool. How do you want to use that tool? And what does it unlock? And I think, you know, just to sum it all up, right? We put a pin in the Web3 discussion of what Farcaster is working on, just to highlight, because I want to, you know, make sure the listeners are getting these things out of it. What has you most excited about what Farcaster unlocks? Because we've talked to a lot of Web3 social founders. We talked to Lens, we talked to Favor, we talked to CyberConnect, we talked to a lot of people working in the space, and each one has a different area of focus. But for you specifically at Farcaster, what are you most excited about? Because there's so many different tools there, and we didn't even dive into really owning your data and letting users kind of, rather than Facebook extracting all that data and selling it and making money on it, it's a very different way of thinking about it. So you, Dan Romero, what are you most excited about when it comes to Web3?
Permissionless innovation. And the reason I say that is if you go back to the beginning of Twitter, Twitter had an extremely open and permissive API. And all of the innovation that happened in early Twitter, outside of the initial app that got built, happened either by users within the constraints of the 140 characters or in third-party clients. It's important to remember, like, if you weren't using Twitter at the time, Twitter did not have a native mobile client. The native experience on Twitter mobile was either mobile web or text messaging, SMS, thus the 140 characters. So all this innovation that then got turned into popular Twitter products. So let's just go through it. Tweets, hashtags, at mentions, never, they weren't originally native, all invented by users or third-party clients. Quote tweets invented by third-party clients. The simple UI UX experience of pulled refresh, which is used by every app today, that is technically owned by Twitter. They don't prosecute anyone on it because they bought a client called Tweety, which ended up becoming the initial Twitter app. And so I think that's, it's so important to get to a place where anyone with a good idea and the ability to code and layer on now ChatGPT and the ability to like be able to actually prototype something that much faster can just get going on it. They don't have to wait for API access or worry about Twitter removing access to the API, which they've done twice. They did in the 2014 era that significantly hampered the third-party ecosystem. And then more recently, Elon just shut it off. And so being able to build on top of a protocol, just like the web, which think of all of the companies that have been able to build on top of the web by just being able to spin up a website, not asking for permission, right? Airbnb, like you could just go build that. Like there was no like app store approval for Airbnb, right? Uber, like you could just go do that, right? And so this permissionless protocol web has generated so much benefit to consumers and to society and to the economy. If you can actually do that for networking as a primitive, I think that the amount of innovation in social will increase by orders of magnitude. Because now so much of the bootstrapping and difficulty of getting started has already been solved by a protocol. And we have a ways to go here. But I think if you believe decentralized social protocols can actually get to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of users, I do think you're going to get into this really exciting cycle of permissionless innovation. So people with an interesting new idea can go test it out, can quickly gain users, and then actually start to build a new social experience that isn't beat by Facebook because of network effects, because you've actually commoditized the network effect into a protocol.
Yeah.
And now, just like anyone who has a web browser is effectively a daily active user of the web protocol, if you can actually grow these social networking protocols to some sufficient scale, then I actually think it's going to be that much more attractive to developers to build on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's awesome. And it's awesome to see. And I think it's really cool that you're building a Farcaster for everyone out there. And again, you know, it's cool to see the different track that all of these founders have taken in trying to establish a better version of what we've seen in Web 2 and the rise of the tech giants. And I think, you know, to your point earlier, having that platform, having that ability to, I guess, do this is increasingly important, and having an alternative is increasingly important. And just to go back big picture and full circle here, I suppose that does get us back to kind of the main thing happening right now when people are looking at what does the world look like when that alternative, crypto, to the traditional financial system right now is being attacked and cut off here in the U.S. You talk about First Amendment rights and free speech and the idea of free money and having that right. And that's something that has increasingly been debated in the crypto space. And you know, Dan, I know you only had an hour, so I want to be respectful of your time here on the space. We're going to be getting into bigger topics, including the reports of Do Kwon's arrest, the former founder of Terra, as well. But Dan, I mean, you know, when you put into today's news cycle and the ideas right now around censorship and what's going on with this crackdown, I also am curious to kind of leave our listeners with your takeaway in terms of how important this moment in time is when it comes to, you know, what we talked about and the freedoms that people have in Web3 right now, but the very real danger of some of those things being cut off and how you look at it. I mean, how serious is the need to ring the alarm right now?
I'm not alarmist by nature, and I really pride myself on trying to be pragmatic. I do think we are in a period right now where the financial rails into the crypto ecosystem are as kind of weak or brittle as they've been in my entire 10 years In crypto. That said, we've had periods like this before, maybe not as exposed because crypto was smaller or it was maybe just for Coinbase. So there was a period in kind of 2015 where I don't think people appreciated how close crypto access was basically almost shut off in the United States. I do think Coinbase being a public company, it helps make that it makes it less likely that the rails will be lost, because I think Coinbase gives a lot of legitimacy in terms of like the partners that they do work with are much more comfortable working with a public company than a private company. So I think that milestone is really, really important to keeping the rails open. I think the push from the regulatory agencies, particularly the SEC, I think I kind of hinted at this beginning. I think it's probably largely political in the sense that they had a lot of these things in the hopper. And then the FTX thing blew up, egg on the face. I mean, Gary Gensler was meeting with SBF, but suing Coinbase. Like that's the reality of where he is. And so he needs to appear to look tough on crypto. Mm-hmm. I do think most of these cases, if they do end up in court, will take years and he will be long gone, whether he continues to be in the administration or not. So I think he gets the kind of political victory of like, hey, I got really aggressive on this, if you consider that a victory. But I do think we're in an interesting situation where you have a kind of split Congress, right? So the Republicans control the House and the Financial Services Committee there, and then the Democrats control the Senate with the Senate Banking Committee and Financial Services. And I think you have differing opinions on different sides of Congress. And so just today, I think that there was a bill that was introduced that was bipartisan. So I think it was Tom Emmer from Minnesota and a congressperson from New Jersey who's a Democrat that's trying to drive clarity. And so maybe you do get actually some legislative action, which I think this is the important thing to take away. When there is a lack of updated legislation, the regulatory agencies operate from this kind of like weird gray area with outdated laws, right? Like we talked about before, the 1946 case, Howey is about orange groves. That is the test of a security today in 2023.
Yeah.
Right. So it's an 80-year-old, not even a law, it's actually a Supreme Court ruling. And so to maybe get over the next few years some actual federal legislation that starts to define crypto in ways that regulators can actually take a modern approach. Like I'm not advocating for no regulation. What I'm advocating for is regulatory clarity, which there are two ways to get that. So you either get that through congressional action, which maybe that happens, or, and this is the tweet I did yesterday, Coinbase goes to court with the SEC and presents the facts, and the SEC makes their argument, and then an impartial judge makes a decision on whether or not, you know, there were good faith effort. I mean, Coinbase is claiming that they met with the SEC 30 times. Okay. Every time they said, hey, we're open to your input on whether this set of assets or this product is security. Silence from the SEC. And then the SEC sues them with this Wells notice or, you know, intent to sue.
Yep.
And they say, oh, well, we think some of these products are securities. So wait, this is a company that 30 times tried to come and say, hey, we want to follow the law. Like we've built our brand on following the law. And so I actually do think over the next couple of years here, one way or another, we're actually going to get to some level of clarity in the United States. And once you have clarity, I actually do think things will improve. And maybe it's a little harsher than people in the crypto industry want, but at least kind of a real line in the sand with actually like a court decision that actually maybe updates Howey as it relates to digital assets, I think is generally a good thing for the industry because it allows entrepreneurs to follow the law and build new apps and services that aren't in this kind of like weird gray area that maybe the big bad SEC is going to come and hit you with some lawsuit 2 years in.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we've been shifting closer and closer. Everyone's been watching this too, and there's also the Ripple case pending from the SEC as well. And the idea that this has kind of been the water quickly boiling and reaching that kind of moment in time where it spills over has always been, I think, you know, clear to a lot of people in the industry. And where it goes from here, I mean, I didn't exactly know when all this stuff was going to hit, but obviously, I think right now, with the banking crisis kind of going on too, it's kind of hit that moment in time, and now the SEC getting extremely aggressive. But Dan, I enjoy the pragmatism. And I like the optimism of seeing maybe getting some of these answers. And again, you're right to point out, I think what a lot of people have seen in the way that Brian Armstrong at Coinbase has flagged this as, look, we tried to get answers. And a lot of people have been extremely frustrated with the idea of regulating by enforcement rather than, you know, actions and laying out the rules. so everyone can follow them. It's been a constant gripe, I think, in the entire crypto space. But want to thank you for coming on, man. Honestly, I appreciate these discussions with founders because we learn so much. And obviously your insight from being a VP at Coinbase and all the things that you've been working on. It's exciting for Christy, I know.
I feel like I could be a spokesperson for Farcaster, and I didn't get to get in this, but I am obsessed with the way you have built this. I mean, I have made friends from this app already. I'm getting drinks
and that's tough
with a marketing director from Rainbow Wallet tomorrow because we met on Farcaster. So if you're not on this app, you really need to get on it. It is really great. Like, the community is phenomenal, what you've built.
Thank you. And I mean, it's a community effort in building the community, right? So one thing I want to offer anyone listening, if you send me a DM on Twitter and you use the word Arizona, like the state, in your DM, I'll prioritize you today. Right. It only kind of works for today-ish because what will happen is the airdrop farmers will find out about the word and then they'll all send me a message later. But for if you kind of do it in the next couple hours here, I'll prioritize that set of messages because I know you spent time listening to this podcast.
Yes, there you go. The alpha leak for our Coinage listeners there is Arizona. So DM Dan, you know, he's the co-host of the space, so you can't miss him. DM the word Arizona to get priority there.
That's good. Our community enjoys it. They were DMing us asking how to get on this app because I flexed about it a lot on my own personal socials too. It is, you've built something really great. I just want to say thank you because I love the app. I use it every day.
There you go. And that's honest coming from
Christy. Thank you for using it.
Dan, I appreciate you coming on, man. You got to come back. I enjoyed the conversation. It was really nice to meet you as well. Hopefully we can have you back on and chat more big news in crypto, which is what we do here at Coinage. But I appreciate you taking the time, sir.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I want to keep the space rolling on and discuss some of the other big news that we have coming out today as well, because there is a lot to get to. And if you're just tuning in on the space, one of the biggest stories we're tracking right now is news out of Montenegro, which is something that I didn't think I was going to say today, to be honest. I don't think I've ever discussed news coming out of Montenegro before. But the headline coming out that there are reports that Do Kwon, the founder of Terra, who we've documented and highlighted with our first interview after that collapse on Coinage, that Do Kwon was arrested in Montenegro. Those are the reports. And it all stems from one tweet from the Minister of the Interior in Montenegro. And that is what a lot of people are trying to track and follow right now in terms of what's going on that front. And anytime you just have one tweet waiting for confirmation, there's not a lot to go off of on that front. So we're tracking that. We'll be discussing that in just a sec, as well as what we're just chatting with Dan, which is the Wells notice for Coinbase. If you've been tracking that one, the stock rising in the session, it was earlier down on the open, off by about 20%, now off by about 10%, as the whole sector, the whole industry and investors react to pressure. Again, the SEC getting very active in terms of applying pressure on the crypto industry. And Coinbase, as we've been discussing, one of those companies that has always tried to navigate the question marks in the industry from above board. And the SEC coming out, basically a Wells notice for those who don't know, signaling that the SEC is going to take aggressive action. And as Brian Armstrong, the CEO of Coinbase, has been tweeting, that it will essentially result in a lawsuit coming from the SEC. The other headline came out yesterday that the SEC, again, getting very aggressive, also flagged and moving forward with a lawsuit against Tron and the influencers attached to Tron that had been promoting that. So that's the other story in terms of where you know, the aggression, the activity from the SEC is ratcheting up. But again, tracking the news that we are seeing and the headlines, trying to get confirmation around the Do Kwon piece, and want to bring on to the space here alongside me the producer who was with me in Singapore when we did track down and interview Do Kwon around some of this stuff.
My, how this story has traveled, huh?
Yes, Nate Skid, our producer at Coinage. And Nate, I mean, this is one that I guess, you know, a lot of people have been watching. Of course, if you hadn't kept up on the Terra story since we covered it back when it first collapsed, the SEC also filed a case against Terraform Labs and Do Kwon. What was that? A few weeks ago. So it's not necessarily coming out of the blue that, again, Do Kwon has been looked at, not just in the U.S., but really globally, as South Korean prosecutors continued their search for him. But now this report that the arrest in Montenegro.
I mean, this is the one thing that during our time with him, he said he was, I don't want to say concerned about, but it didn't seem like he was under extreme duress in that moment. I'm wondering what they found that could have pushed this forward.
Well, the other tweet that we're looking at here, and this is flagged from Zach Abrams, is the Korean official confirming that Do Kwon was the individual arrested in Montenegro. That coming from Yonhap, which again is a legitimate source of news. So I would give that update that it is not just the one tweet coming from the Montenegro interior minister, now also from Yonhap. So that is, I suppose, the update in terms of tracking what exactly is going on there. But yes, the main question being, you know, why did it take so long? That's what a lot of people were wondering.
Well, why did it take so long? It's just, you know, we spent, I don't know what, 6 hours talking with him. And you know, to a person, it didn't seem like he was being disingenuous in the moment. And so I don't know what it must be like for him to have been like, what is this? He's been kind of like dodging this for a year now. And I just can't imagine what his mindset would have had to have been.
In terms of?
Well, just in terms of, I mean, you think about it, like this guy built this incredible thing. He creates this incredible persona. You know, he seems like he's the crypto god, untouchable on Twitter. And now here he is getting caught in an airport with fake documents on the run in Montenegro. And like, what a downfall.
I think, yeah, the discussion around, you know, how long this has taken, it's an interesting foil to what we saw play out with Sam Bankman-Fried. Just because that happened so quickly. When you think about, obviously, both collapses happened very quickly. Let's be clear on that. The collapse of FTX and the collapse of Terra Luna both only took a few days from start to finish in terms of people talking about some of those problems and where that goes. But the arrest, very different timeline in terms of that, in terms of how quickly regulators stepped in and you know.
Well, one guy was like, walking the halls of power in DC, you know, and the other guy was, you know, hiding out in Singapore. So, you know, you could see it from that perspective. And also like FTX just seemed to be much more embedded in American culture. I mean, Tom Brady, Gisele Bündchen, you know, it seemed like FTX was really geared up to be like the actual bridge between, I guess, like traditional normies like myself and the DGen community. Whereas like, you know, the whole stablecoin, Terra Luna, it was very heady, very hard to understand. So it didn't really penetrate, I think, like FTX did. Plus, Sam Bankman-Fried, like Do Kwon's alter ego was an asshole. Let's be honest. He was like the king troll of crypto Twitter. SBF was like trying to play the white knight role, right? And so I don't know if it was just proximity to the US that made the SBF case happen so much faster. I just think it was easier for people to look at it and go, God, that's shitty.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, the other piece of all this, right, is the complexity of Terra and what it is still, that's again, why we spent so much time highlighting that story, because I think it's a very different thing in terms of were you using customer funds versus the idea of something that was supposed to work, an algorithmic stablecoin. And of course, the SEC case highlighted maybe some of those promises, as our piece did, weren't exactly real.
Yeah, but I want to get into this a little bit, because what exactly is it? Was it the Chai payment system that is the big problem for him now?
I mean, there were a lot of things highlighted in that fraud case. The SEC, you know, again, filing that and going after Do Kwon and Terraform Labs was highlighting a few different pieces of it.
Yeah, but when we were in Singapore and the news came out that Korean prosecutors were looking for him because of Chai, that was fucking wild, right? And so that's where my head goes, because that was like the most obvious case to me where, okay, like the line between hyping up something beyond what it's able to do, like, I don't know, keep me honest.
Theranos.
Keep me honest here.
You're talking about the Theranos.
No, I'm not talking about Theranos. I'm talking about Chai. Like, if there was supposed to be a payment system that you could use your crypto to buy a cup of coffee or a tank of gas or your groceries, like, the is that like promising more than it could do, or is that just like flat out lying because it never had that capability? And so, you know, when I think about fraud in ways that aren't overly complex for people to understand, that's something that I can wrap my brain around, which is, you know, here's a guy who had no idea of the limitations of something, or maybe he did, we don't know. And he was saying how great it was and how much it was already doing and it wasn't. Like, is that one of the major reasons for this fraud case? I'm literally asking you to help me understand this a little better.
I think so. One of the main things around all this is a mix of that. And I think that that's always the most, you know, interesting piece. And honestly, since we published the story, think about all the anger, right? The anger that was there when we first published the Terra story about Doquan.
I was not ready for the amount.
There was a huge amount of backlash of why are you talking to this guy, blah, blah, blah. And everyone basically, you know, in the wake of everyone losing, myself included, losing a shit ton of money in Terra, everyone was very angry about that project failing and also angry at Doquan because, to your point, had been a very boisterous man who had ran that whole project.
A boisterous man. Speaking of, if anybody in the audience wants to chime in and talk about this, or maybe you got rugged by him, I don't know. If you want to air some grievances, let us know. Definitely, we'll have you up as a speaker.
Yeah, pop up as a speaker as we continue this discussion and track the news. I think that that is one of the big pieces, and the most interesting piece of the Doquan and Terra story is that it evolved from kind of that tone, that reaction to everything. And then you had kind of this weird foil in what happened with FTX and SBF, and everyone saying, okay, that's a little bit clearer to digest. It's a little bit easier to digest anytime if customer funds are being used to plug holes. That's easier to know something's going wrong than maybe this project failed. And, you know, a project failing is less fraud, maybe more failure. And that was always the interesting piece of the Terra story. But now you have the other news, which is just, you know, a man on the run and then arrested.
Doe on the run.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to Singapore, because we did spend time with him. Nobody else, I want to say, had. And we had the story, I think, before anybody else did. We won a Cebu Award, a national award for the reporting on this story. But like the most interesting point or aspect of it was just how much he didn't seem like he was a fugitive at the time. He had no, did you get that sense too? He seemed to be pretty open, pretty forthright with all of his questions. He didn't seem to hedge on anything. He never shortened the interview or anything like that. He never dodged a question. And so it's just weird, in my opinion, like the human part of this story, which is, you know, from, you know, man to man, it's like, how much did he hide? How much was he playing us, or was he being honest? Because at the end of the day, you know, what he had said was, there are two points that I thought were interesting. One was that he legitimately seemed as if he felt he did nothing wrong. And he leaned into the Chai payment system and saying, did he lie about that, or did he stretch the truth? Was it marketing or was it not? That was one aspect of it. But the other aspect of it was and this is way beyond my ability to understand, but the moving funds from one liquidity pool to another, and how he said that that was like a targeted thing that had happened. So if he left that wide, if he left that vulnerability open, and as he said, it was just business, so he wasn't mad about it. I'm not following necessarily how, if that was the case, it's actual fraud. So I'm wondering what they're going to find in the discovery phase.
Well, I think always, though, you know, when you think about these things, right, in the pursuit of this, as far as, you know, the idea of innocent until proven guilty, because I think that that is, you know, one of the pieces that always looks a little weird when you're dealing with, and again, Doe had never claimed he was on the run. He was very combative with kind of the idea that, all right, I'm not going to face these charges. And we asked him about that in our interview too, in terms of, all right, what does it look like when these charges get brought forward? Because when we were interviewing back then, basically, prosecutors were circling his co-founder's home and had raided his home while we were interviewing him. So there was already a pretty clear way to connect those dots in terms of, look, you are going to eventually have to answer these questions, and what's that going to look like? And his whole thing was, it's about due process. It's how you are prepared to answer those questions. And the idea that in our interview, it sounded like he was prepared to answer those questions, but then was running around. And it became increasingly clear, all right, he's not in South Korea. He's not in Singapore anymore. Where did he go?
Yeah.
That obviously the public is able to make their own conclusions from, all right, if that's the case, you would just face the investigation. And that is kind of what we're seeing play out with SBF.
Well, the point that he made was he didn't want to, I think he was ambivalent about going to Korea. He didn't want to go back to Korea because he said that the Korean charges were kind of nebulous, right? Like he said that they weren't really well formed, or it was just kind of broad and vague. I think when the U.S. Investigators started looking into the fraud, maybe it took a bit of a turn.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
I mean, I think yes, the main piece there is that and this is something we discussed on multiple shows, was that, you know, is the idea of what are you prepared to face? And we had heard that from him. And the main point was, look, his communication was, I don't know how prosecutors are going to try and go about this. It's similar to, actually, weirdly, I think it's similar to what we're seeing play out here in the U.S., right? We were just talking to Dan. Coinbase is now facing these charges in terms of where this lawsuit with the SEC is going to go. It hasn't happened yet. They filed the Wells notice. We know that's coming. The question is, how are you going to act as a player in these situations when you're going up against the people who make the rules? And so that's the toughest question I feel like people in crypto, myself included, anybody who watches this space has to face is, are you a bad guy because you've broken the law? Because if the law is you're selling unregistered securities, even Coinbase might be pursued, and it looks that way, that they are breaking the law because they're selling unregistered securities. Why? Because the SEC says they're unregistered securities. And who can say that? The SEC. So it's kind of a question of, is the same thing that Doe is basically saying, is that Korean prosecutors are going to come after me because they're going to say Terra was an unregistered security. I don't agree with that. And so it's going to be unfair for me to face these charges in that jurisdiction. And now I think, you know, we're seeing kind of similar things play out with a lot of huge players in the US. And yeah, it's the same thing.
It is. I think we have a
granted, couple. I don't want to say it's not exactly the same thing, because obviously, as we highlighted, there were a lot of things where you're stretching the truth in terms of what Terra could do and what would happen. And, you know, we saw that. And that's very different than a platform just selling things. But at the same time, there have been lawsuits against even Coinbase in terms of quote unquote insider trading and whether or not that happened with employees. And, you know, that's a very different suit, but just flagging that piece.
That's a great distinction. Hey, I think we have a speaker coming up.
All right, great. Yes. And also our head writer, Zach Abrams, in the space as well, who has been tracking kind of these updates and brought us that update. If you're just tuning in, the Yonhap news confirming that Do Kwon was indeed arrested in Montenegro. This kind of search for him had already been underway. Korean prosecutors had been looking for him in Singapore. Obviously, that's where we interviewed him. And then, you know, he moved on from that country, and it had been reported he was no longer in Singapore. A lot of people were wondering where he was in the world. People discussed him being in Serbia. And the report's out now saying that he was arrested in Montenegro using falsified documents. And Yonhap now also covering that news as we're tracking it. But yes, we have other people popping up on the space. And by all means, if there are questions or things to add to the conversation, we'll be monitoring all of this in real time. Nate, the other thing too is that we had clips from our interview.
Yeah.
And every time. So the interesting thing is every time, granted this happens, anytime you have a story that you know is going to develop, these things change, and the context in which, you know, they were said clearly sounds a little bit different. One of those two that we had flagged earlier this week, right, when we were tracking all this, was kind of the idea of, you know, Do Kwon's thinking around not necessarily getting arrested, but it was more around
currency.
Yeah, the idea of
currency.
Other currencies that could fail.
Yeah, and you know, when you talk to people that are this smart, it's kind of hard to really grasp sometimes in the moment, like you had just said. So do you want to play this clip just to hear kind of like what his mind was like, what he was saying right there about the
currency? Let's flash back. So let's flash back to the summer of last year when we were chatting with
Dan. Yeah, we're going
to
be digging up clips for the next little bit too. So here's one.
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess we're gonna queue those up and then play them through.
You know, possible with any currency, let alone Terra, any currency can fail, right? Like I think right now, if the situation gets any worse, we might even see a collapse of the Eurozone and the Japanese yen, right? So even currencies at that scale, the third largest economy in the world, the largest economic collective in the world, like their currencies could fail, rationally speaking. I guess the only thing that sort of tipped the balance of my thinking into thinking that USD would not fail was because, number one, I thought we were living in the golden age of Web3, and I think we still are, mm-hmm. where you're seeing like an explosion of growth of decentralized technologies. And Number two, the way that we would program things on top of these digital currencies would be a lot better managed from a risk perspective and a lot more transparent. Thereby, I felt like a lot of the risks that are manifest in central banking planning policies would not be applicable to UST. Both of those things were wrong.
There were a lot of things that were wrong, I think, since we've seen it all play out. And obviously, everyone who watched the collapse knows that. But there's a very big difference in terms of things going wrong and things that are illegal. Also on a flag, we got Vanessa Harris up here as a speaker. Vanessa, it's interesting because a senator at Team Kujira, there's a lot of, I think, people who were in the Taro ecosystem who have eyes on Kujira. But I'm not sure if you have anything to add around the news coming out of Do Kwon or just in general, kind of the Taro look back now as we're seeing this news circle.
Thanks for having me on. So it is kind of very curious to me. You know, you look at how fervently they've pursued Do versus, you know, letting SBF sit at home and play video games. And I can't help but wonder, like, what's going on with all of that? I know that LFG did an audit, and apparently it showed that they were above board with their funds. I don't know kind of how fully true that audit is. So I'm very curious, like, what do they still have on Do that they're still pursuing him? And maybe there's something that we don't know that hasn't come out yet. But from everything that I've looked at, it appears though he developed something that broke very badly, but that there wasn't any personal fraud involved from what I could see. So I'm very curious to see what the accusations actually are and what kind of evidence that they have against him.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Vanessa. I'm one of the reporters here at Coinage, and I was covering the Do Kwon story. And to me, the one thing that keeps coming up again and again when you look at the legal notices around Do Kwon is the relationship, the precise relationship between Terra and Chai. So for any listeners on this space who aren't familiar, Chai was a South Korean payments app that used Terra stablecoins as payments. Terra was originally co-founded by Do Kwon and Daniel Shin, who later left to work on Chai. And Zach Guzman can speak to this, but Chai was one of the major selling points around proving that Terra had real-world adoption in the early days. Do loved to go around to different conferences and different talks talking about how the fact that Chai was successful proved that Terra wasn't just this abstract financial magic happening in the clouds. It was something that was real and affecting real consumers. However, over the course of our reporting, and as more revelations about Terra have come to light, it's become clear that Do wasn't as involved with the Chai team as he said he was, and the Chai team had pivoted away from using blockchain technology or using Terra specifically over time. So plenty of the investigations really want to drill down the exact relationship between Terra and Chai and whether Do was intentionally misleading people by saying that the Terra blockchain had these real-world applications when maybe it really didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. This is the other piece, right? There's so many different jurisdictions that are exploring what really happened, right? And it's not just the U.S. Of course, if you remember just a couple weeks ago, you saw that case filed by the SEC in the Southern District of New York City looking into what exactly happened. And there are a lot of claims. Keep in mind, though, this happens all the time. You have these lawsuits filed and they claim a lot of things happened based on the, you know, reporting and, you know, record subpoenas, everything that happens in the normal line of putting together a case. And, you know, the SEC's lawsuit is pretty detailed in things, the allegations of violations. And certainly, I guess, if you wanted to pinpoint those, Vanessa, when we're looking at those, there's a few different things. It wasn't just the idea of Chai maybe not working to the way that they were describing it. And keep in mind, even in our interview, we highlighted that Do was saying things were existing in terms of users actually transacting on the Chai Payments Network on the Pomp podcast that weren't actually true. And he admitted to that in our interview that that was essentially basically, when you think about fraud, it's misrepresenting reality. And this isn't my definition of fraud. This is actually Do Kwon's definition of fraud, which we also got in our interview, which is misrepresenting, overpromising the functionality of whatever product you're putting out to the public and that not being true. And that is something that we basically got from him. But yeah, if we want to play his definition of fraud, this is again, oh, we're not that one. That is something that was in our piece. But that's, I mean, Vanessa, that's a really good question because I think that does get to the heart of what exactly each jurisdiction is trying to figure out. But the main question is, if you were pretty confident in your case, I don't know, and this is just me speaking personally, and maybe this is wrong, because certainly we've seen a bunch of other people caught up in crypto who have not necessarily gotten what they would call a fair shake in some of this stuff, as, you know, as temperatures have soured when it comes to any crypto founder. You can look at Nate Chastain from OpenSea, who's facing his own kind of insider trading case over, what, $60,000 worth of NFTs, and how long that's been drawn out and the cost that he's now had to pay in defense fees. So maybe, you know, everyone listening on this would tackle this in a different way, and maybe you wouldn't want to actually, you know, in your own jurisdiction, get arrested and face these charges in the court of law. Maybe you would just say, I'm going to not stay in this country and move on. But now, obviously, that's not a choice. When you're arrested, now you have to face these. So that to me is, I guess, you know, where this has now evolved is, yeah, we're going to get the answers to whether or not everything that's highlighted. And of course, I think the SEC's case is the one that really does, at least from what I've seen, the best job of highlighting what went wrong and what was illegal, allegedly illegal. And now when you have someone arrested, they have to face those charges. And that's theoretically how you get these answers. So I don't know if that answers your question, but what are you looking at? Because I think there's a lot of pieces moving here.
Yeah. And for me, the thing that's just extremely frustrating is we've had very recent examples of a lot of centralized exchanges and custodians where people have repeatedly lied about things. And these folks, you know, the SEC hasn't come knocking. They haven't done anything. And so I'm just wondering, I keep wondering, like, why they're going after him so hard versus all these other folks that are sitting around, you know, having a good time. Not to say that Doe hasn't done anything bad. I don't know, you know, the full extent of that. But it just seems like the enforcement is sporadic, and that it appears that there's more at play here, maybe politically, than just the rule of law.
No, that's a good point. And I think that that's kind of what the parallel between Coinbase right now and Terra is interesting, just because, you know, that's how regulation goes. You go after mainly the biggest fish, right? That's where all the attention goes. And you go after those, and everyone in the space learns that lesson. And, you know, it's shitty because, as we've been discussing, if you are Coinbase and you're trying to operate above board, you just can't get answers over what's legal and what's not legal. It basically makes the game impossible to win because you're constantly moving the goalposts. And in the case of Terra, I suppose that's the same kind of principle being applied, because they were the largest algorithmic stablecoin in terms of the market cap when you wipe out $40 billion. And also you add on top of that the spiciness of a quote unquote international manhunt, then you've got a lot of eyeballs on it. And if you're a regulator, you try and, you know, draw the line on where all the eyeballs are, because then everyone sees that and they see what's off limits. And so that's essentially, you know, what anyone watching this would say is the playbook. You go after the big fish so everyone downstream learns the lesson. And that's unfortunate when things turn against you. And the same thing can be said about SBF and FTX, because that is a even bigger example, I think, in terms of people who aren't even in crypto. They certainly knew the name FTX because you had Tom Brady and Larry David and everybody else talking about it. So it just becomes an even better example. And that's, you know, again, very different stories. We actually had Do Kwon on in a space not too long ago weighing in on SBF's positioning and how that whole case was being pursued. And his whole thing was, again, I think he may have said the same thing, is that you kind of create examples out of this and you go after those big fish and everyone else in the space learns. Abrams, I don't know if you've been monitoring kind of the other updates here, but that is, I suppose, the big news. We were waiting on whether or not other news outlets would be able to confirm the news that was coming out of Montenegro's interior minister. And then Yonhap put that out. But Abrams, have you been checking in on anything else that's been popping up?
Yeah, so far it seems like people are discussing this reported arrest, but there aren't more in terms of details.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I don't think that that's necessarily going to be the case. It's not going to be the case until the case moves forward.
I just dug up a pretty interesting clip. Well, that kind of shows that kind of shows Do Kwon's his like firm belief that he absolutely did nothing intentionally wrong. Here, let's give this a listen.
You're a smart guy, and you know stablecoins probably better than everyone in the world, I think. And you knew the risk around depegging. When it comes to those risks now, though, it's like you're making those decisions in your seat I don't know if in your head you're thinking about what could happen to me as a person if this fails.
I like literally didn't think about that even for 1 second. I've never thought about what could happen to me if this fails.
Really?
Not even once.
Why not?
Because I didn't think that this would fail.
But it's not even in the back of your mind, like, what do I do if this fails?
Not even once.
Have you failed before?
Not really.
I mean, that dude has got, like, supreme confidence, or at least he did.
That was always the main thing, though, right? When we talk about the everyone in crypto talking about, I guess, the founder effect, right? And, like, being the proponent for your project. And there was no shortage of confidence or ego. And, you know, Doe even said that, right? It was another persona he created on Twitter.
Yeah. he was pretty conciliatory about it, though, right? Like, he was like, yeah, maybe it was a little extra.
Yes. Well, in hindsight, sure.
Oh, God, those tweets are embarrassing now.
But no, I mean that's kind of what you need, though, right? If you're trying to create a project, and it's no different than anything else we've seen in the crypto space, you have a very confident founder. You basically always say that this is going to work until it doesn't, and then you're not there anymore. But I do think, you know, a lot of people have been tracking the similarities too, and this is where my mind explodes, because right when you think about what happened with FTX and the confidence break. In terms of even the banking crisis that's going on right now. And we're talking about this too in a new episode that's coming out on YouTube today. So if you're not following Coinage, if you're not subscribed to Coinage on YouTube, you should do so now. But I mean, the confidence piece of the banking crisis, the bank runs that we saw, it's almost a perfect parallel to what we saw play out with Terra. It works until you have people who lose confidence and they say, I want my money back right now. The difference is, right, Terraform had TFL, or Terraform had their own Luna Foundation Guard, the LFG, that had a limited amount of Bitcoin. A few billion in the bank to support the thing.
And like, you know,
the difference between that and what's going on in the banking world is the Fed has unlimited money to print. And so there is a huge
I don't know, because I like go to Balaji and I'm like, I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing, that that's the only reason why we're not panicking even more.
Well, in the same fashion, they had unlimited Luna to print.
And that's what happened.
You know, more hard assets backing UST than the banks are required to hold for deposits. So it's exactly the same confidence game.
Yeah, I mean, the ratio there is obviously, you know, mandated in terms of banking and regulation. But yeah, it's never exactly one-to-one. We saw Custodia. Caitlin Long has been trying to do that in the U.S. to get approval of having everything fully backed one-to-one, and she got denied.
I think a great point was just made, though. Because, like, the difference between Luna and the Fed, or what the only difference between them is that people have more confidence in one than the other.
Well,
and what
but you know why.
Yeah, I know why, but what I'm saying is, like, every time there's a big bailout, or every time there's something like that, it just cheapens the belief in the system. And I think that the big thing for crypto, I guess, at large, is that there's not widespread, I guess, the widespread belief in the system has been dampened in every, you know, Terra and FTX, like, just further erodes that confidence. And I just feel like the same thing is happening in the traditional finance. It's just taking a lot longer. And I'm actually, I've never really been concerned about that before, but the more I kind of understand how much of our system is just built upon the belief, like, the belief that things will continually run. I don't know. It's kind of interesting when you start to peel it apart.
It is. I guess, you know, again, the main distinction there being, what is it backed by? Is it just backed by belief, or is it backed by the idea of a government?
I'm not disagreeing.
And that is the interesting thing. And that's always the thing that gets kind of lost in this. But I mean, that again goes back to the idea of, did everyone in this investment structure, right? If you bought into Terra, again, I did. I think a lot of people in the space probably did as well. Like, that is our own decisions. It's like, you look at it. Where it becomes annoying, though, and I think this is where a lot of the legal piece of the pie will come, and what a lot of people may be looking forward to, is getting real answers in terms of what wasn't represented honestly. In terms of, and again, our piece kind of explores this, is if you knew that people weren't using the Chai payment system to use UST.
Well, there was just an alpha leak, a little one. We were chatting off record with him. And this was after the interviews.
chatting off record with him.
Chatting off record with Doe just a little bit. Sorry.
What do you mean by off record?
Not
chatting
off record,
with him.
But this was just after the cameras were off. And I remember asking him or saying, hey, like, are there, if there's text messages, because the whole thing was like, did he know or not know that Chai was like not functioning, right? And a lot of what we were discussing in that moment was on that. It was just like, dude, if there's like text messages, there's anything like that, that could be the hangup, right? Like, and so that's what I guess is like, what was really going on? What was it? And I think that,
well, that was what a lot of people, I think, you know, right. And we put this in our piece, so it wasn't really off the record at all. It was a discussion after the cameras turned off, to be clear, in the way that you're framing that.
Oh, I'm sorry. The discussion after the cameras turned off was
why did you really want to do this? And this is kind of where I think, you know, we got a lot of criticism once we put our piece out, was just the question of, is this to be trusted? And is this to be trusted when you're talking about someone whose project just failed is a very interesting question. But the question there was, why are you speaking now? And I think, you know, SBF ran into the same issue. And it's like, hey, do you really want to speak when you're about to face some of these legal consequences? Any lawyer would say it's better not to say anything. And that's true. And I think you've seen that play out with SBF in the way that he has not spoken to reporters as frequently as he did, because we saw more charges come out of some of the things that he discussed in terms of campaign finance laws that may have been broken. So generally lawyers would say, do not say anything, and for good reason. And so when we were interviewing, we asked Doe and said, why would you be speaking now? What's the point? And I think it gets back to the same reason as to why he wanted to not face charges at the time, which was, I don't want, basically, you know, if I'm going to face these, I'm not going to get a fair shake. So I'm not going to face them now in South Korea. I'm not going to be there for that. Said, look, our lawyer, very frankly, he said, my lawyers are saying, don't speak to media, but he wanted to anyways.
I mean, they were bluntly saying, do not do this at all. I don't know why he did. It's like, I really would highly suggest anybody that's interested in this story to watch the longer cut of the day two interview of the interview that we did with him, because Zach walked him through the kind of like philosophical debate between what he was doing and who he was doing it to. So if you're just pumping Chai, you know, that's one thing. If you're pumping Chai based on your community's love and adoration for the project, that's a whole other thing also. And so just if you really want to get into the kind of like deeper question of what was going on in terms of how he was either manipulating his audience on one hand, or of how he was genuinely excited about a project on another, and what that means. I just thought that was a really masterful way to force him into the philosophical discussion at that moment. So anyway, I think there's something there actually to extrapolate, which is like, you know, and I'll even ask you, Zach, like, what was that? What were you walking him through? What was the point of that line of questioning at the end of that interview? And I highly suggest people to watch it. I don't think you'll get a clearer sense of.
I need to rewatch. I need to rewatch.
It was fucking amazing. To be fair,
I think we should rewatch it just internally in our community too. If you're in our, if you're a Coinage NFT holder, we might just post the full unedited kind of full thing, because we're all kind of going back and looking at some of this stuff with a new eye.
It was chess in the moment.
I'm kind of surprised, by the way, that no prosecutors anywhere in the globe ever asked us for full interview footage. That was, if I were a prosecutor, I really wanted to get to it. It's probably something I would want to see. And I do think it is interesting.
I don't really want to step into the middle of that.
I do think it is interesting too, though. I mean, when we talk about Terra as a project, right? Terra, you know, Luna 2.0. Only off 2.5%, which is interesting. If you think about Doe's, you know, stranglehold in terms of being the end all be all for Terra, and whether or not people still believe in a project when its founder goes down or is arrested or things like that. We've seen more drastic moves in any crypto project whenever there are, you know, pieces of this come out.
Yeah.
And that's kind of muted, I think, a little bit. Vanessa, I mean, obviously we had a lot of conversations with Terra community members, people who were in that community. As I said, I think a lot of people, Donku, another friend, had shifted over his attention to Kujira and other things being built in the space. But I think there is still a little bit of that overhang when it comes to people who had been hurt by the Terra collapse and, you know, their thoughts on where other crypto projects, as Nate was saying, might get dinged or hurt or lose confidence because of what happened with Terra.
Yeah, I mean, that. I think that's a great point. And for me, there's a couple things I separate in my mind. First going back to, did people know the risks? How much risks were they taking on? I think there's definitely a difference between people that invested in Luna, knowing the risks, but also having an extreme upside reward from people that invested in UST, where I think many people may have viewed that as just a bank account that had a great interest rate and not fully understanding that, you know, UST could go to zero. And I don't think it was ever represented to those folks that UST could go to zero. So that's kind of one separation. And I definitely feel for those folks who took UST as something that was a stable coin as they kept, you know, talking about it. But then the other side of it as well is, you know, there's Terra the chain. And there's the builders on Terra, and Terra attracted some of the best and the brightest builders for, you know, a number of different projects, Kajira obviously being one of them. And there is a little bit of an overhang still from that entire experience on the builders of those projects, I'd say unfairly. A lot of these folks are really very, you know, generous in the way they've approached it. I know in Kajira in particular, what the team did was, one for one, give people tokens that they had on the old system, on the new system, at great cost to the team. And so I think there's a lot of people with high integrity, who are building on Terra and just got, unfortunately kneecapped along the way with it. And so I'd encourage folks to separate people who were building on Terra and now trying to build somewhere else like the Cosmos from, anything that Do Kwon himself has done.
That's a really good point. I think that's, the Cosmos ecosystem is another one that was kind of, I guess, largely attached to Terra since, the Cosmos SDK project. And I guess the idea of where a lot of those community members went. And again, I think a lot of other cryptocurrency projects, Polygon, a few others, incentivizing developers in the ecosystem to come over to their ecosystems was interesting to watch in the collapse. But you're right to make that distinction between, projects that are still building that might be facing a dotted line to one that maybe didn't go so well. And that might be putting it extremely lightly, but yeah, that was one of the most impactful things and, sad things to watch when, I had a lot of friends in this space and a lot of people who were building on Terra just completely caught blindsided by that. But I think that's, again, unique to building in crypto is that those are things that you have to be wary of in terms of, is the foundation we're building on, which again, Coinage NFTs are on Ethereum. I think largely for that reason was just looking at, all right, where should we put these things? And the Lindy effect, to use that phrase, of cryptocurrency, of crypto projects that basically have started and how long they're going to last. And that's one thing that I think, was fascinating to watch with Terra is because, it had started to establish that Lindy effect, if you want to call it that. But many of the detractors were just saying, look, this is destined to fail at some point because, again, to Vanessa's point, the confidence game there of exactly how much was in reserves to back something. When you got $40 billion worth of market cap floating in terms of Luna's size, only backed with about a few billion dollars in reserves, was always potentially a sign once the panic started what would happen. And again, a very interesting parallel when we think about the banking crisis playing out right now and the bank run that happened and resulted in the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature getting closed.
I like to think a lot about kind of the catchphrase that Do would use often, which is a decentralized economy needs decentralized money. And regardless of everything that happened with Terra, we're seeing that to be absolutely true. With the DPEG recently of USDC, as some of their fiat backing was caught in one of these banks in Silicon Valley Bank. And the flight of people to Liquidity, which is an over-collateralized stablecoin, and the stablecoin that they have, even on the Kajira side, USK, there was a lot more kind of trading volume around that. So I think the entire ecosystem needs that decentralized money. And if we'd had UST when all the banking crisis was going down, oof, the world would be a very different place right now.
Yeah, I think that's interesting in the way that, again, we're right to call it out. The decentralized economy needs decentralized money was the main foundational point that Do, on platform to platform had always kind of trumpeted. And it was true. I think anyone watching it, if anyone believes crypto ideals, it was extremely weird to think about, well, why would we all be piling into a centralized stablecoin? Why would we all be holding USDC if there's a single point of failure there? Which we kind of saw when it depegged to 88 cents because they had billions of dollars in Silicon Valley Bank. And that was a big issue. He was right. He was right in that being a problem. He was wrong in Terra being the solution in the way that it was built. And how wrong was he, I think, is, again, what this whole kind of case will come down to when he faces the music. Yeah. But again, I think, you know, that is still something. And you saw CZ from Binance tweeting about it the other day, is the idea was right. Execution was poor. And what does that mean for kind of still having a gap to fill in the industry when it comes to a decentralized form of money for this decentralized economy? But yeah, Vanessa, you're right to flag all that. I think that's another fascinating piece of the puzzle.
Well, I dug up a clip that I was kind of mentioning before about like Doe's fundamental belief in the difference of crypto projects versus traditional. And I think it's worth listening to. Should I key it up?
Go for it, Nate.
As communities, right? So I think like the 3-3 move put up by Olympus doesn't really make that much sense from an economic perspective. But I think it's indicative of how crypto assets are a little bit more than simple financial assets. They're not like equities. They're not like commodities. But for a lot of these tokens that represent...
Why aren't they like equities and commodities? Because it signals more about who you are, what you believe in?
Because you're not supposed to be passive investors, right? Like every crypto community encourages and tries to galvanize this community to some higher moral calling, right? So the moral calling of the Terra community was to deliver the promise of decentralized money to as many places across the world as possible. And I think many people took up that mantle and decided to leave their jobs and create companies and do all sorts of things in service of a higher mission.
Or put their money into it.
Yes, a lot of people are passive investors. But I think crypto is unique in the sense that it's converted more of its passive investor base into people that are actually can be called out to action to serve the community in more ways than capital. And I think that's what makes it strong.
But that's the thing that also I feel like would piss off anyone who believed in your mission and felt like they were a part of that mission. And you're saying that you don't have an emotional response to that. Which me, as somebody...
I did not say that I don't have an emotional response. I'm just saying that I've tried to make a calm-headed decision to categorize this as business and to move on to other things.
And the alternative, if you don't?
Yeah, I mean, from a pure emotional standpoint, look at it from my standpoint. Like, it's the reason why I haven't shorted any cryptocurrency is not because I'm a bad trader, right? Like, of course I know how shorting works. I know sometimes when there are opportunities. Like, everybody tells me things, right? Like I was like a top 10 project founder. Like I have information, but I don't trade those things, not because I don't know how to make money, but because I know that things represent more than simple financial assets. That if I shorted a community or I acted on information that I have that other people don't, that there's other people on the other side of that trade that get hurt.
This is where it gets good, Zach.
Well, that's what we were just talking about, right? Yeah. Because the idea of, again, a very strong thesis and a very sexy thing that sucked a lot of money and a lot of people in, myself included, and
glad
the idea of we
hear
need
it
that.
Early. If I heard it earlier, I would have been right with you.
Yes. We do. I see Juge's hands up if you want to join in here as well. If you had anything to add, because, you know, obviously looking at all these moving pieces.
Hey, thanks for having me up.
Of course.
I hope my voice is coming through clear.
Yeah, we hear you.
I'm in the middle of dense wood walking the dog. so far, I'm finding the conversation very interesting. So many points have been touched, but I just want to come back to something Vanessa said, which I thought was quite pertinent. So one of the questions she asked maybe 5-10 minutes ago was, did people actually understand how the Terra system worked? Yeah, the stablecoin worked, how Luna worked, and how everything else worked. So I'll make my point. I just want to draw your attention to a slight tangent. So let's look at the crisis that's happening right now with the banks and the bank runs, you know, Silicon Valley Bank, bank run. What was the other one? Silvergate or Silver something. Bank run.
Silvergate.
Yeah. So these are all regulated banks, okay? And they operate within the confines of rules and laws. Now, if I had money in one of those banks, and I wasn't fortunate enough to have some in those banks, unfortunate rather, if I did have money in those banks and those banks did collapse, you know, I'd be pissed simply because I would think those banks weren't operating to the confines of the rules. So let's now go back to Doquan and Luna. You see, right now, within the cryptocurrency space, you know, it's for the most part largely unregulated. I know we're talking about regulations and things like this, but it's largely unregulated. That means it's on us. That means it's on me. It's on you. It's on the listeners. It's on everyone to do due diligence on the products that we're using. Yeah. So I was one of the users who lost a fair bit of money in Terra's collapse. But, you know, as much as it pains me to say this, it's my fault. You know, I was sucked into the 20% returns on Anchor Protocol. Mm-hmm. I knew in my heart of hearts it was an unsustainable return, but I still did it anyway. I made a bit of money, fine, fair enough. But I also lost a large chunk of money as well. But, you know, you live, you learn. My underlying point is this. Given we're operating in a largely unregulated crypto market, where does the blame lie? I think it's convenient to blame Doquan, but how much of that blame do we take as users?
Ooh.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is also one of the largest things, myself included, and I appreciate those questions and points, Juge, because that is that was the tough thing about our piece at the time when it came out, because if you recall, there were a lot of emotions around that time, and we got a lot of hate, and we got a lot of you know, things where people were not looking at themselves. I think, you know, it was all Doquan, it was all Terra collapse, it was all not my fault.
To be fair with that though, because you sat across from him and you asked him specifically, what research could somebody have done to have avoided losing money in Terra? Right? Like he was so steady, lads. Everything's going to be fine. Chai's doing great. It's kicking off in Korea. So is it huge?
Huge. But the point being, I think on that front is that, yeah, the transparency aspect of it all. But I mean, it is, again, if you are in a space that is DYOR, do your own research. And again, to I think the point you're getting to, Nate, is just like, what more could I have done as a user? And you could see everything kind of happening on Anchor as all the money was flowing out, as the panic was growing, and the idea of people knew how this end game was going to go, because once that panic sets in, and that's, I think, why Balaji has been so loud right now about the idea of banks going down, is because you're looking at the same thing as our piece that's going to be coming out on our YouTube highlights, is look at the size of the FDIC insurance right now, about $200 billion in terms of deposit fund, and look at the $18 trillion in terms of deposits at banks, and look at that mismatch and say, how does that work? It's exactly the same thing, kind of. The difference is that you've got the Fed and the government that can do anything, and not the same case for LFG. They had limited funds. But the point being there is that it's the same. And Juju, I think it's a good point in that a lot of it does fall on users because, of course, you know, the only person who knows risk reward is the person making those bets with their own money. But I think, again, to the larger point is, you know, I think a lot of things in these cases highlight that there wasn't exactly full transparency on the part of, you know, Doe and what he was saying in interviews, even around the time right before the collapse.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Just quickly jump in. I agree. I mean, I'm not saying for 100% all of the blame should be on the users. No, you know, there was some dishonesty. I can see that, and that's fair. I just think it's disingenuous for us as users to place 100% of that blame on Doquan.
Oh,
now,
for sure.
You know, slightly tangential, you know, if you bank with, you know, I don't know who you bank with, is a regular high street retail bank, you know, you kind of take it at face value that the money that you have in your retail bank, it's safe. You know, everyone likes to take the piss out of fiat and how inflation's rising and all these other memes. That's fine. But, you know, we go about our lives on the understanding that our money in the banks are safe. Yeah, and that's what Jerome Powell's trying to do now, is trying to save the banks and all that other stuff.
Sure, but I think when
you know, just we can't take crypto in the same vein simply because those protections are not in place.
Yeah, I think it is a really interesting point in parallel there in terms of, you know, what you initially raised in like, okay, like look at the end result. I mean, that is the main difference there, right? In terms of playing these risky games is that if you don't, if you're not part of the system, you don't have the system to rely on when shit hits the fan, which was the case, as you're right to point out, Juge, that, you know, these banks ran into issues and what happened? The Fed stepped in. You saw all the regulators step in, at least here in the U.S., and say, we can't let this bank fail. So we're going to, you know, back deposits and say that this bank is systemically important, which normally wouldn't have happened. But we're going to, you know, help depositors not lose all their money in this bank. And so if you look at, I guess, the end outcome, those people are fine. And this is the point that Eric Voorhees made in our episode when we were talking about the revolution. So I would encourage everyone to kind of go back and look at our episodes on our YouTube page, because that point being that, you know, when these things fail and you have the system there, yes, everyone feels good. Everyone's like, oh, I didn't lose any money. But if it comes at the cost of devaluing the dollar in the long run game, everyone's hurt. Everyone's hurt because the value, the dollar is actually worth less. And so it's like kind of a slow bloodletting, which I think is Balaji's point and why he's singing the alarm right now, raising the alarm, is that like over time, the reason why Bitcoin's at 28 still in all this is that I think over time people are realizing, okay, that's going to happen every time in every crisis. I don't think that it's going to go to $1 million in 90 days, but I do think in the long run, it's a marathon, not a sprint. People are waking up to that exact point, Juge. And I do think it is maybe the one that we should end on here when we think about why it's different, because who gets helped and who gets hurt in these, if it's a crypto project or if it's a bank, but very much the same principles in here.
There's also, I thought we made a fairly good point in the episode, which is like, there's a big difference between a community at a bank and a community of crypto enthusiasts, like, you know, behind a project and its leader. And I think like, I think if we end, we could end on the playing out the rest of this bit of the interview, because we get to that philosophical question, which is, you know, what is the difference between the community that buys into crypto and somebody that's just looking to invest and make some money? So let me tee this up and play it. And then I think we can get out of here.
Having said that, that doesn't mean that I should let my emotions guide, you know, on like objective what other people do, right? So everybody's from different circumstances. They just make different decisions.
That's fair. If someone comes after me, if the tiger eats me, I can't blame the tiger. Right. If the tiger eats my family, I'm going to kill the tiger.
Have you heard the analogy of the market being a jungle?
Yeah, but it's people. Like you just said, it's people believing in certain things. And, you know, there's the downside beyond just numbers on a screen. It's people. Right? I mean, I guess at the same time, you could flip that and say, all right, you're building this thing up. You're sucking people's money in. It's like, it's just a jungle. Could be a way to look at it and say, you know, it wasn't my fault. But you also believe that there was some blame that should be put on your shoulders. So it just seems kind of like looking at it as it's a jungle when someone attacks Terra, but also you're saying that some of this is your fault too. So that kind of seems inconsistent.
Interesting philosophical discussion. I think there's aspects to this where participants are humans. I think there's aspects to this where we're beasts. Interesting discussion.
He did not know what to do with that.
It has been an interesting discussion. And I do think, you know, those are the things that everyone who's been watching this play out are left with. And those are the things that I appreciate you, Juge, coming up. Vanessa, I appreciate you coming up as well. We'll continue to have these spaces as we do every week, Monday, Tuesday. And then our new episode out is actually dropping in about 30 minutes on our YouTube to dig into this Balaji bet and everything else. But I appreciate everyone listening to the Coinage Space, the community-owned show. Our NFT holders, of course, also available on OpenSea. You can co-own what we're building here at Coinage as well. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Appreciate you tuning in.
Thanks for checking out another episode of the Ether. That was Coinage Crypto Breaking News on Thursday, March 23rd. 2023, discussing Doquan, Coinbase, Farcaster, and more. Hosted by Zach Guzman. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, if you want to keep listening,
head on over to terraspaces.org/donate and show some support. Sneaking through back alleys on a little cosplay, Broadway all day, looking like the wrong way. Resuscitating major players in the waiting room, sifting through the paperwork while I be debating fools. Breaking rooms, breaking bad, like we always wait for doom. Slayed a few in my early years, often hit the shroom. Sitting in the dark, waiting for the daily news to let us know what we should believe as the latest truth. Stay aloof, writing rhymes in the studio, trying to keep it well lit like filming a movie role. Sorting through support from your endorsements, of course we're tripping balls, handing reports it. The latest proof ain't a way to move, change the view. Just a bunch of pack of heads living in a chicken coop, picking at the dinner, finger licking like the plate is good. So kick it for a minute, then show me what that thing could do. 2+2, show me what that thing could do. 2+2, show me what that thing could do. 2+2, show me what that thing could do. 2+2. Big thinking energy always gets the best of me when I kick it in the lab, messing with new recipes. Gotta mix and match, flip the lash, letting rhythm scratch. Dope shit, spitting facts with my vision smash. Big trip aristocrat, dishing out a list of trash. Missing wisdom, this fish is too big to catch. Better let the missus know where you hit the stash. Watch your next step, bro, before you hit the traps. Walking on eggshells, tripping over landmines, and I'm about done dealing with these damn lies. Man, I'm looking at this planet like a franchise, chastised into digging holes in the back nine. The latest proof ain't a way to move, change the view. Just a bunch of peckerheads living in a chicken coop, picking at the dinner, finger licking like the plate is good. So kick it for a minute, then show me what that thing could do. 2+2, show me what that thing could do. 2+2, show me what that thing could do. 2+2, show me what that thing could do. 2+2.
Terra Spaces.